afternoon. Mr. Peterson?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is John Peterson, and we represent, I'm joined here by my partner George Thompson and Jerry Wiskin of Simons & Wiskin. We represent Ributech Products, the appellant in this matter. Your Honors, this case presents a question of first impression, and the question is this. When a patent owner has obtained a Section 337 general exclusion order barring the importation of goods that infringe particular patents, may it then go to the district court and ask the district court to issue an injunction against the importation of precisely the same goods covered by precisely the same patent claims and the same exclusion order?
Doesn't the district court have independent jurisdiction under 271A?
The district court has jurisdiction of certain patent matters under 271A unless the court were to conclude that this is a matter that arises under the international trade laws, in which case 28 U.S.C. 1340 would suggest that the district court might not.
But this is a different. This is different parties, different kind of case, different remedies.
Not necessarily a different remedy, Your Honor. Here's why. This court said in Texas Instruments versus Tessera, in comparing 337 orders and district court injunctions, that the difference is that a 337 order essentially has its own self-executing provision for customs exclusion of the goods.
Yeah, 337 is against the products, whereas this action is against parties.
But the enforcement of this action would be an exclusion of the goods enforced by customs, as this court said in Texas Instruments versus Tessera. And the problem here is that Fuji walks in its own footprint. The claims in the injunction and the execution and the enforcement of the injunction would trigger an exclusion under Section 337, which would be protestable.
Isn't your real complaint with Congress and not with the case law? I mean, you clearly have Section 271A a remedy. I mean, Fuji does. It says the act of importation is an act of infringement.
They say
you want an activist panel of judges to rewrite the law for you.
No. What we want the court to do is to enforce the rule of primacy of jurisdiction that was enunciated in the Orleans case.
Right, but I mean, if you look at your footnote 8, you concede that there is clear authority in the district court to entertain actions for post-importation, right?
That's correct.
And so the very goods that the CIT has held to be non-infringing, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Those goods can now be challenged by Fuji, and if you try to sell them in the United States, right? And the district court could come to the conclusion that those are infringing goods. So you're willing to concede that there can be inconsistent remedies between a 271 cause of action and a 337 situation.
Well, there shouldn't be inconsistent decisions.
So the real beef is simply with allowing the district court to enjoin importation. If you're willing to let the district court decide that the goods that the CIT has held are not infringing, you're willing to let the district court find those goods are infringing, then it seems to me that you've got a tiny beef, if any.
Well, I don't know that we're willing
to. Haven't you conceded in footnote 8?
Well, what we're saying,
you don't challenge the authority of the district court to entertain action challenging post-importation conduct.
Your Honor.
And so some of these very cameras that the CIT has said the customs was wrong to hold them up, right? CIT said
in
no.
In a different but related case, yes.
Right. But just assume it's the same box. It seems to me that you're willing to allow the district court to chase down cameras after they pass through customs. If they pass through customs as a result of a CIT order that the goods are not infringing, Congress left a remedy where you can have an inconsistent result.
Well, the question of whether a CIT decision would be binding on the district court with regard to that matter isn't really before the court here. What footnote 8 is meant
to. We know it wouldn't be binding. We've already held that.
I know, what footnote 8 is meant to indicate is that what we're merely challenging is the jurisdiction of the courts,
district court to enter an action seeking an injunction that duplicates the 337 remedy.
But that's a comedy question rather than a jurisdiction question, isn't it? I mean,
well, under the Orleans,
the district, as Judge Clevenger has pointed out, there is overlapping jurisdiction here, and Congress may have made a mistake in creating that, but it did create it. So the question is, once the CIT has jurisdiction is attached and it's considering whether to exclude particular goods, it strikes me that your real argument is that the district court ought to defer to the CIT and stay its hand so that it doesn't issue an injunction which is inconsistent with what the CIT has done.
Well, it's not even a question of being inconsistent. It's a question of intruding on the CIT's exclusive jurisdiction.
What are we dealing with? Are you worried about the goods that were ordered to be excluded by the ITC and whether those goods can be sold abroad without incurring U.S. liability?
No, we're not to that issue yet. That would be further
down
the line.
Which goods are you worried? Are you worried about the goods that are admitted under the exclusion order or the goods that are excluded under the exclusion order?
We're worried about both, and here's why. At the time this case was filed, Ribitex merchandise was already the subject of exclusion lawsuits that were pending in front of the Court of International Trade. Those cases, some of them are still pending. Now, the issues are exactly the same. The questions of infringement are the same.
Yeah, but is there a conflict between what the ITC exclusion order does and what the district court injunction does? Do they require different things with respect to either category of merchandise?
Not to the extent that the ITC, that the district court injunction is ever enforced by customs, as this court indicated in
Texas.
Well,
that's not the question. Do they have different scope? In other words, the ITC is allowing some things to happen which the district court is prohibiting.
That would be the case. I mean,
in what regard?
Well, the scope is exactly the same. The claims of infringement are for the same merchandise for the same patents. So the proof of infringement is the same.
I think we're talking about the relief. I think the question Judge Dyke is posing is the relief that the ITC afforded to Fuji with a general exclusion order the same in scope as the relief that the district court is providing to Fuji in the injunction here?
It is. Actually, the ITC order is broader because it covers more parties than just this plaintiff. It covers everybody.
I mean, for example, does the ITC's general exclusion order affect in any way your client's freedom to take the goods back out of the United States?
No.
Does the injunction here in any way impede your client's freedom to take the goods out of the United States?
No, but we're talking about our ability to bring them into the United States. That's what concerns us.
I'm not understanding this. I thought your complaint was that under the ITC exclusion order, you were allowed to re-export the things if the things were found excluded.
We're not barred from that. This case isn't really about the re-exportation.
The district court order has nothing to do with that.
No, they haven't blocked us from re-exporting. What this case is about is importing.
I don't think you've read the injunction, sir. I've got the right one. It's in the appendix, right? Page 005.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case,
your client is restrained from delivering outside the United States to persons or entities known by a person subject to order to intend to export to send it back in, right?
As of the time that was issued, I think anything that had been exported by my client had already gone out.
Okay, but the point is that you're not concerned with taking the goods away from the United States once there has been an exclusion order or an injunction by the district court against importation.
No, we're concerned about importation.
What's the problem? In terms of importation in the United States, what's the problem with having the two injunctions? Do they impose inconsistent obligations? Do they allow different things? What's the issue?
They impose duplicate burdens. They require duplicative litigation involving the exact same patent claims.
That's too abstract. What is it in practical terms? What's the difference in the scope of the two orders?
The injunction is broader insofar as it covers exports, obviously. and may cover resale in the United States.
You're not concerned about that. What about things that are coming to the United States? Are the orders different? Do they have different criteria in them?
No, they don't have different criteria as far as infringement and defenses. But the problem is that they require litigation in two different courts. And it intrudes on the jurisdiction of the CIT.
You've already said you don't mind being hailed into the U.S. District Court for any post-importation act.
Well, but that assumes that the importation is allowed to occur. We're talking about whether the importation will occur. The problem here is if Customs has excluded goods, which they have in certain cases, we have to prosecute an action in front of the Court of International Trade to demonstrate non-infringement. But then, after that happens, we have to go to the district court, and we have to prove to the district court a second time the exact same facts and the exact same defenses. Now, this is a case.
Doesn't 1659 envision exactly that?
I don't think it does because of the, again...
It concedes that there's jurisdiction in both places. And it says that on your request, you can get a stay to stop one during the pendency of the ITC proceeding. And then you come back and finish up what you have business
underway. But 1659 only applies during the initial ITC investigation, which was many years ago. In this case, the ITC investigation is long finished.
But it shows that the U.S. Code considers there to be jurisdiction in two places.
At that stage, yes, but 1659 does not speak to what happens after an exclusion order is issued.
Did you ever ask the district court to stay its hand pending the outcome of the ITC
proceeding? We asked them to, we moved to dismiss this case, but the district court's not looking to stay.
Did you ask for a stay?
I don't know that we asked for a stay specifically, but we certainly couldn't ask for it under 1659.
Well, but you could have asked under general principles of comity the district court to stay its hand.
Well, we did ask the district court to stay the case pending this appeal. They declined.
That's a different. But you did not ask to have the district court stay pending the outcome of the ITC proceeding.
There is no ITC proceeding. There's Court of International Trade.
Pending the outcome of the Court of International Trade review of the ITC.
Yeah, the district court indicated, though, that they don't consider themselves to be the least bit bound, or they don't care about that. So it's not going to avail us anything.
The answer is you didn't ask them to do that.
We didn't ask, but it's within their discretion. I mean, it really wouldn't be appealable one way or another if they were to grant it or not. The problem here is that ultimately, if
you'd asked for a stay, and the stay had been denied, you could have appealed the denial of the stay as part of your appeal on the grounds that there was an abuse of discretion in not having granted the stay.
It would have been on abuse of discretion standard.
So fine.
Well,
and that's where you would have raised, if you had wished, the comity issue.
But we think it's under the Orleans Doctrine. We think it's more than a comity issue. We think it's an issue of jurisdiction.
The Orleans Doctrine is dealing with a different statute. It's with the Beef Act, and it talked about under the Beef Act, it doesn't anticipate that there would be a duplicative procedure. This is a Patent Act. And 1659 says there's two procedures. And we said the same thing in Texas Instruments. Quoting, in fact, the patentee can bring suit in both the district court and in the ITC against an alleged infringer who is importing an allegedly infringing product. We can't depart from Texas Instruments.
Right, but I don't think Texas Instruments spoke to the question of what the patentee can do after the 337 order has been issued. And as this court said the other week in the Jazz decision, when a 337 order is issued, Customs represents the patentee at the border. The patentee would have Customs almost be in an advisory role and say, well, if Customs excludes it, that's fine. If they admit it, we're going to have the district court review
that. It's happened before, hasn't it, that there's been a difference between an ITC proceeding and a district court proceeding? And in that case, what did we say? The district court proceeding controls.
Yes, but not under these specific facts where the patentee walks in the footprint of the 337 order. Okay, I take my time.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. We'll hear from Mr. Rosenthal.
Your Honors, my name is Lawrence Rosenthal of Strzok & Strzok & Levin of New York City. I represent Fuji Photo Film. who is the plaintiff in the district court. I regret that I have to open with an observation about Your Honor's decision in Texas Instruments, which is one of the foundations of the reply brief. Your Honor, in that case, observed that the patentee, after getting an injunction from the district court, can take the additional step of requesting customs to enforce the district court judgment by seizing the offending goods. Unfortunately, there is no authority for that in law or regulation, and in fact, if you try to, customs would laugh you out of the room. The reality is that one of the differences between the ITC and the district court remedies that one tells clients or lectures about is the fact that customs is one of the groups who enforces ITC orders and doesn't enforce district court judgments. Now, there was a second part to Your Honor's observation that the ITC...
Are you trying to re-argue that case?
Huh?
Are you trying to re-argue that?
No, Your Honor, but it's one of the linchpins of the reply. It's quoted extensively and says that's what makes the two injunctions the same, which it doesn't. The other point, which Mr. Peterson did correct, and I think he really knows that both are wrong, was that the ITC automatically enforces its judgment by directing the U.S. Customs Service to seize infringing imports. It's not automatic. It's a very circumspect circumstance that seizure occurs. But again, Mr. Peterson corrected that observation in a footnote in the reply brief, but wrote on the back of the first quotation. The other part of the issue is the so-called Orleans doctrine or rule or whatever you want to call it. And here,
so how much conflict is supposed to be worked out? If you have two parallel injunctive proceedings going on, it's not so much of a problem if it's a damages action in the district court, but if you have two parallel injunctive proceedings going on between the ITC and the Court of International Trade on the one hand and the district court on the other, and there's a potential difference in scope between the injunctions or interpretation of the injunctions, how's that supposed to be worked out? If it's not a jurisdictional matter, which it appears not to be, how is it supposed to be resolved?
Well, the statutes, unfortunately, as I think Your Honor observed, created this situation, and the statutes.
But there are lots of situations like in which this. Lots of situations under lots of statutes where there's overlapping jurisdiction. There's a lot of law about this, and courts are supposed to try to avoid issuing conflicting injunctions. Right,
Your Honor, the court is issuing only one injunction, and as Judge Rader observed, its rulings have primacy over the Court of International Trade. I don't really view...
Well, isn't that the question? I mean, you just said, well, its rulings have primacy over the other court. That's the whole thrust of your adversary's argument.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's...
Primacy lies in the 337 proceeding along with its enforcement mechanism.
Well, the CIT, in my view, and I think the way the statute is written, is reviewing what customs determination that the goods should be excluded or not excluded, which in turn is interpreting the order of the ITC. And the court almost applies an administrative law test in reviewing the judgment of the CIT, not the test that's used in the reviewing of district court cases. The court has repeatedly said, in another Texas Instruments case, is the leading case, that the rules... That the findings of the ITC and even the finding of the Federal Circuit in dealing with the ITC's decision are not res judicata or collateral estoppel, although they're entitled
correct.
To...
Correct. So, but how do we work out potential conflicts? How are the district courts, the Court of International Trade, supposed to work out potential conflicts between their injunctive orders? Are you saying there's no mechanism?
Your Honor, I believe that that's Congress's problem.
So they just go their own way without anybody caring that the injunctions may have different scopes.
The CIT doesn't issue injunctions, Your Honor,
in this case. The ITC
does. And
they review it.
They review it. If the district court were to find...
Suppose there's a conflict between the relief granted in one forum and the relief granted in another forum. How is it supposed to be worked out?
Well, in our case, it actually was worked out because in the initial ITC decision by this court, it set out a test for permissible repair process that had 8 steps. When we went to the district court enunciated a 19-step rule, which they conflated into the 8 steps. When we were in an enforcement proceeding against Mr. Bannon and Jazz, who was Ribby's predecessor, the ITC adopted the district court 19-step process, so that there is a give and take between the two forums. They're not acting in a vacuum.
Let me pose you a hypothetical and ask you what would be your view of how the problem would be solved. Let's assume, for example, that the ITC's general exclusion order permits the person that brought the cameras into the customs warehouse could freely re-export them. They said, once we've decided that these goods are infringing, then you can send them anywhere you want, you're free. You take the same cameras, the same hypothetical, the U.S. District Court enters an injunctive order requiring the importer to destroy the cameras. Not only doesn't allow them to re-export, it says destroy it, right? Now, those would be two inconsistent injunctive reliefs over the same act of infringement, right?
Well, not strictly so, because the ITC has no power to order destruction or seizure.
I understand that. That's the problem. And the U.S. District Court does, presumably. Subject to review. So just assume in a parallel proceeding you had one general exclusion order that said to Bannon, well, go ahead and take your cameras back, sell them in Japan, wherever you want, just not in the United States, right? But the U.S. District Court decided that a more drastic remedy was required, destroy the cameras.
And the question is,
is that really what Congress intended?
Apparently it's what Congress, the language of the statute, the statutes leave you, because certainly 337 says in addition to other remedies.
Would a district court have abused its discretion in entering an injunctive order requiring destruction of the cameras?
District court is operating on a different set of rules and facts. The district court has before it a lot of information that the ITC may not have in front of it when it issued that order. For example, in this particular case, in our particular case, what the district court did was not order the destruction of the goods. What the district court ordered was stop. You sold them for sale outside the United States. Fuji repeatedly said they wanted to sample these goods because it's their best evidence of what the goods look like. Let Fuji do it to the extent that they can capture them. We caught 10 out of 17 or 18 containers. We took one camera out of every 10 cartons.
But you're not addressing the conflict problem. I mean, I would have thought that your answer would be, if you start out with an ITC proceeding and you're worried that the district court could enter an injunction, put aside damages, that's inconsistent with that, maybe you should go and ask the district court to stay its proceedings.
Well, this court has repeatedly said that they dislike the practice of the district court either staying or ordering the stay of the ITC. And so I don't think that's a practical remedy.
We've said the district court can't stay its own proceeding?
Not that they couldn't, but you discouraged that kind of order. And the practice has developed over the years that the ITC doesn't...
We've discouraged what kind of order?
You discourage staying... an order of staying the ITC.
No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm asking you about an order in which the district court says, I am going to stay the district court proceedings to avoid a conflict.
That has happened, Your Honor.
There is a remedy here.
Well, that's a possible remedy, but it doesn't apply in this case. And I know it's an academic remedy, which is always available here.
Are you aware of a circumstance in which that has happened?
Well, First of all, the statute provides for that circumstance.
I just was asked, as a matter of your experience, because your answer to Judge Dyke just a second ago suggested that you were aware of an instance in which a U.S. District Court had either sua sponte or at the request of a party stayed its hand pending the outcome of a 337.
I have not personally experienced this, but I do know that when the shoe is on the other foot, and I've asked district courts to stay either itself or the ITC, I've been told no. So I am not aware of a case that's the other way, and I don't think it's even what Congress contemplated. District court cases take a sufficiently long time relative to the duration of an ITC case so that it's likely that the ITC case will be completed long before the district court gets to a judgment stage.
Did you ask the district court for the provision in the injunction that affects the freedom of Benin to re-export or to export the goods?
The only, yes.
This is the language that says they can't send it out, delivering outside the United States to person or entities known, you know, to intend to bring it back in again. This is on page 5 of the injunction. In paragraph 1, it's hereby ordered that.
That's, Your Honor, that's not the import of that language. That language is addressed in effect, an infringement inducement. That says that
what
they can't.
What does it mean? Help me out a little bit.
All right, Your Honor. What it means is that Bannon and Ribitech are prohibited from selling the goods outside the United States with knowledge that they're either going to be imported in the United States or are going to be resold in the United States. And that has a historical basis that there was a period of time in the history of this case when that's exactly what Jazz did. They sold outside the United States through a subsidiary to, for example, Walmart, who then bought it in. And
okay,
that
so this injunction doesn't prohibit them by complying with the exclusion order by selling the goods abroad as long as they're not going to come back into the United States.
No, Your Honor, the only issue...
Yes?
No, it doesn't prohibit the exportation. What is on the block and before the district court is whether the sale of the goods which are already in the United States is itself an act of infringement which justifies an award of damages, but not injunction. The injunction has nothing at all to do with that issue. The court
let me just stop you for a second. The theory here is that selling in Tokyo, making the sale of the cameras in Tokyo to somebody that Benin knows is going to bring them back to the United States is barred, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. It's a form of inducement.
A form of inducement?
Of inducement. Knowing that the goods are infringing, selling the goods to someone who is going to commit an act of infringement.
The sale is
going to
induce the act of importation.
Of importation, which is an act of infringement or sale in the United States.
So if you were making something abroad, right, and you were making it for someone that you knew was bringing it to the United States, you think the U.S. District Court could enjoin that conduct?
If you know, yes. I think that's a knowledge issue under 271, whether
or not...
Do you
have a case? Is there a case where that's happened? I mean, ordinarily, making, using, or selling outside the United States is a free shot, you know?
Your Honor, I apologize that I can't cite to the case, but I will represent that there are cases where the issue, the defense usually is the foreign defendant says, I am not subject to this court's jurisdiction because I didn't do any acts that violative of the U.S. patent.
Right, but don't you have to have the act of importation?
Well,
I mean, hypothetical, let's assume your client's making something abroad and you know perfectly well that it's infringing and you say, fine, I can make abroad anything I want.
Well, infringement inducement requires that there be an infringement.
An act of infringement. Right.
And this injunction requires that there be an act of infringement, which is either importation into the United States or sale into the United States.
Intention to import. Intention to import.
Well,
it's
knowing.
Excuse me?
It's knowing, Your Honor.
But that hasn't happened. I mean, this injunction is going to reach something that's not an act of infringement, right?
Well, I don't think so as a practical
matter.
Okay,
let's assume. Just read the injunction. Well, assume that Bannon sells these cameras outside the United States to someone that they have reason to believe intends to bring them back to the United States, but the person never brings them back to the United States. That's why I asked you my hypothetical about making something outside the United States.
If I make
something outside the United States that's infringing, and I sell it to somebody who tells me it is my intention to bring those goods to the United States, that between the time of expressing the intention, they decide to send them to England.
Your Honor, it may be a literal violation of the order, but it would not be one that would be cognizable by the court for the simple reason that the predicate of this arrangement is inducement, and inducement requires infringement. And I don't think that there's a court, certainly not the district court we're in front of, who is going to look at that issue or concern itself with contempt if infringement doesn't occur in the United States. I think that's the bottom line.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenthal. Mr. Peterson?
Thank you. With very little time, I'll just try to make two brief points. First of all, with regard to the Texas Instruments versus Texera case, the court did use the word seize, but I think if you look at the decision, it's pretty clear that the court meant exclude. That was really the intention of that. But secondly, I'd like to address Judge Dyke's question of how do we avoid the conflict. And I think it's more than a question of comedy. We think it's a question of statutory jurisdiction. Congress has always tried to keep the district courts and the Court of International Trade out of each other's business. And there's two statutes which we think come to bear here. The first is 28 U.S.C. 1581A, the exclusive jurisdiction of the Customs Service of the Court of International Trade to hear protest actions. The inexorable result of the injunction that Fuji has received here, if it's enforced, will be a customs exclusion, which we will protest, which will get us back into the Court of International Trade. The district court should not be involved. This is a case exclusively going to the Court of International Trade. The second statute, which at least indicates that intention, is 28 U.S.C. 1340. Yes, this action is brought under the patent laws, but because of the 337 order, it also at least arises partly under the Tariff Act. That is an act which provides for the raising of revenue. And 1340 says those cases...
Your real argument is that when 271A refers to an act of importation being an act of infringement, it's really surplusage.
It's not surplusage because in most cases there won't be a 337 exclusion order in place.
You don't know. But the point is that if you erased, if Congress amended 271A and erased the act of importation as an infringing act, be no harm because any patent holder who wants to bring a 337 can, and the act of importation standing alone is harmless.
Right.
Unless there's some additional conduct. If somebody brings a bunch of cameras into the United States, it sits in customs and they advertise in the LA Times, our camera's cheaper than Fuji, don't buy Fuji at Christmas time, then you've got an offer of sale.
Right.
But my point is it's essentially harmless, bringing the goods into the customer's warehouse.
Right, but when it comes to jurisdiction, again, we referred to the Orleans case before in the Beef Act. The Beef Act had a specific provision saying actions under this act could be brought in the district court. And yet this court came in and said, you know, we do have two conflicting statutes which appear to give jurisdiction to two different courts. How do we resolve the conflict? The court said in Orleans, it was followed by the Ninth Circuit in Universal Fruits, we resolved the conflict in favor of the court with specialized jurisdiction.
I think we're getting back into the things we've talked about before, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.